I think we've got some time for questions. So I'll just
Yep.
open that up.
And we have over 100 people on webinar, so we're going to turn to the webinar first for questions. When we take questions in the room, please wait for someone to pass you the microphone and say your name and organization for everyone. The first question comes from Kate Felberg from MSI in DC. In MSI's health work, we call the agencies who take on managing the scaling process the gap intermediaries, but there are few and hard to find. Any info on who is best suited or most willing to support this pioneer gap would be great. Could we ask the presenters who their intermediaries were?
So that was a question about intermediaries in the pioneer gap. So what we've said, I mean, there's the pioneer gap, which I think is, in our previous work, was much more focused on the enterprise. And then there's this piece, which we're seeing is more about market facilitation, right? It can operate in the pioneer gap, but they're kind of operating at different levels. And I think we've got to see the work that's involved at those different levels too, right? So we see a bunch of accelerators, for instance, working at the level of the firm, who can really provide hands-on support, capacity building, investment to enterprises to get them to scale. But then we also see the role for these facilitators, what I've described, you know, Gates, KTDA, you know, there are a bunch of different types of entities that can do the facilitation. And what we see when we look across all these cases is that facilitation is not a type of actor. It's a type of role. And we, you know, so we can see government stepping into that if it's the right government entity. We can see foundations, we can see aid agencies, we can see nonprofit intermediaries on the ground actually working with them. I think what's key about all these different types of actors, though, is they bring what they're really good at to the problem. And often it's a few different types of actors who can bring complementary strengths to it. So if you look at mobile money, the case of mobile money in Tanzania, what you see is Gates and this local organization called FSDT, Financial Services Deepening Trust in Tanzania, working in a very complementary way. So Gates, obviously, you know, they're sitting mostly in Seattle. They send people over to Tanzania. They have resources that they can, you know, direct to the problem. They have a lot of credibility on the problem, but they don't have a presence on the ground. Right. And so what they can do is obviously break the deadlock around value chain because they're bringing their financial resources. And with their clout, they're able to, you know, get in with the Bank of Tanzania and have a credibility that maybe a local organization couldn't. But then they had to work with FSDT because they weren't there all the time. Right. So FSDT could then be the local organization who would work day to day with the BOT, engage with them on a whole range of other financial inclusion issues, have the local knowledge to bring to that conversation. So this partnership actually between Gates and FSDT was key to making the facilitation work. So I think, you know, there's no one answer to it. I think it's going to be a range of different types of actors, but the key is to think of it as a role that people can step into.
Hi, Ed Katarakis. I'm with Apt Associates. In both of the models that you presented, you talked about a time scale that was quite long. The KDTA, which started in the 50s, and the other one, which had champions for at least 10 years ago. A lot of us in the room are implementers of USAID-funded projects, and we're asked to have results starting from scratch within 3 to 5 years, and there's even a focus on quick wins in the early phases of the project, sometimes 6 months. So my question is, knowing the model and having studied what you've looked at, how compressed do you think that model really can feasibly be? And is that time frame possible? Secondly, I was just wondering if you had studied some of the work that's done by AgDevCo as an impact investor. I believe it's mostly DFID funded, but I know USAID has a dog in that fight. And they've done interesting things in Mozambique, in the Beira corridor, working with smallholders in outgrower schemes. So if you have any comments about that, it would be interesting as well.
Yeah, so time scales are interesting. The mobile money case, actually, if you look at the journey to scale, is about five years in Tanzania. That's about as fast as we've seen it happen. That is incredibly fast. So the work that Kurt was talking about, where we had the 439 companies down to 59 viable at scale, that piece of work, you know, we thought that the time to significant scale was about 10 to 15 years for most models. And those are the ones that make it, right? So lots of them actually just, you know, go much slower, don't get there at all. So it's a much longer time scale than five. And you know, in the case of mobile money, that went fast because the product was, you know, it's what we call a pull product, right? So it's a product that customers, once they're aware of it, actually do want to buy. You know, you don't have to convince them that it's good for them. It's so much better, so much cheaper, so much faster, so much more secure than everything else, that you know, people will buy it. And it was being driven by a corporate, right, who had lots of resources, you know, lots of existing assets and capabilities and networks in the field, so it could grow quickly using existing technology. Most things are not going to go that fast, and I do think this is one of the challenges that we have to face, because, you know, the like most areas of creating social change, it's not fast. You know, just because we're now dealing with market-based solutions doesn't mean everything is going to work very quickly, because the environments we're working in are still highly challenging. And this, I think, does create challenges, I think, for people who are working in this space, and I think has implications also for relationships between, you know, funders and intermediaries, I think, as you were alluding to. And I think one of the ways that we've seen this work well is where, you know, funders have made longer-term commitments. And I think beyond longer-term commitments, it's also an openness to learning. Right. So the other piece that comes in, which we haven't talked about, is how adaptive this process is. You cannot predict. You know, we've laid this out like you can go in at the start and you can draw the picture and you know the barriers and then you have this 10-year program of doing it. And none of them have done it like that. Right. I mean, you go into it and you know 5% of the problem. Right. And then you discover and you adapt. And I think having the right relationship over time, you know, between funders and intermediaries on the ground is actually key to making that work.
Yeah, just to jump in on that, is this... Yeah, good. So first, I'm shocked to hear that you have a client who wants, you know, results faster than you're necessarily comfortable delivering. That's the first thing. But anyways, the point about quick wins is, I think, pretty important. Harvey talked about leadership and various leaders stepping up and taking risks and having kind of the courage and the motivation for everyone to kind of keep on keeping on in the face of a kind of a system that's not functioning at all. And so, quick wins of some sort, I think, are pretty important for keeping that, getting some momentum and keeping it going. And I think the only way, you, I mean, 5 years is incredibly fast, and there was a big company with a lot of resources, and oh, by the way, Gates jumped in as well, that's helpful. you know, that's really fast. And so most of the time, you're never going to get something like that. So you need to identify milestones along the way that you can hold up as a quick win. For instance, on the model slide, which we both glossed over pretty quickly, a big point of that is, you know, the first business model you hit upon often, usually, doesn't work. And so you need to cycle through a lot of business models, right, before you can kind of hit it right. So one indicator of success that something's on the right path is that you're seeing changes in the business model. You're not just trying to force the same. So if you can kind of, what is the path to success? What does it look like? What are some indicators of, are we on that path to success? And if you're not, at least you know sooner rather than later, you can pull the plug on the thing.
Let's take a webinar question. This question comes from Lisa Kuhn, an independent consultant. How did we ever get onto the assumption that anti-poverty investments should be safe investments with quick returns? Is it because there is an assumption that there is a moral limit on upside so we don't attract the early stage investors with higher risk tolerance? It's a question about attracting investors with higher risk tolerance.
So I'm not going to presume to suggest how we got onto this. One important distinction I will note between investing in this kind of enterprise and investing in commercial startups is, with commercial startups, you can have a business model where lots and lots of things fail, but then you invest in something like Clash of Clans and you just rake it in, How many people know what Clash of Clans is? And I'm sorry, for the people on WebEx, my mouth, my jaw has dropped. Really? Clash of Clans? Well, anyway, so I have it on my iPhone, and so I have a BlackBerry, which is my work phone, and then I have my iPhone where I can play games, and, you know, they don't know. Anyways, it made a lot of money. Let me just put it to you that way. So in the commercial world, you can have the hope of really hitting it big, right? And that covers your cost for all these other ones that kind of went belly up. In the impact investing world, the opportunity to really, really hit it big, it's not quite as likely. So it's difficult to recover your costs on the ones that don't work. And so it tends to make investors less willing to make those risks, and they want to invest later in the game so they are more confident they're going to get a return.
Hi, I have a larger question about impact investing, and then maybe getting back to the evaluation question I think that he was asking before. So I'm not sure how much you're actually trying to look into other impacts other than just growing the businesses. It seems like there's an underlying assumption that growing the businesses is going to be good for the economy in general, which is going to address poverty. That's a reasonable assumption, but at the same time, USAID, I could imagine, would want to see some results also with social indicators. Is there any sort of thinking, kind of the triple bottom line idea, where you're looking at environment and social indicators? And if so, you've got people already using mobile phones to do banking. There's other right now, a lot of surveys that are possible via mobile phone to collect data from those same people that could be done from the get-go before, essentially kind of the idea of like the treatment group versus the control, even though it's not really treatment in this case, but it is you can definitely gather data beforehand, right, before these small holders, for example, are growing their tea businesses.
Yeah, so we did think about that question, and we did address it in selecting the cases that we looked at. So there were definitely some fairly high-profile impact enterprises that we decided not to study because we couldn't find any data on their impact. And so that was a question we asked. Now, not all of them were rigorous, RCT type data. But we needed to know enough, for instance, what was happening with incomes, right, with smallholders, to be able to know that that was actually working. Just scaling the number of farmers actually wasn't interesting to us unless it was improving farmer incomes. I do think, though, that going forward, the level of interest and scrutiny is going to be much greater, and so people need to put more effort into this than they have done. And the big question is going to be, who is going to help businesses do that, right? Because that is an additional requirement that we're loading onto these businesses. Can they, as they're growing, really kind of do all of that stuff and worry about, how we're going to track impacts for that. So I actually think facilitators, just to go back to the facilitation element, one of the things facilitators could think about moving into is actually enabling that at an industry level and not just thinking about individual firms.
Pranav Prashad from ILO's Micro Insurance Innovation Facility. I'm sorry if you shared the data in the beginning, I missed it, and the graph went too fast for me to absorb it. But what is the penetration level as a percentage of subscribers in Tanzania for mobile money? And secondly, how many of them are actually active users of mobile money? Because we've seen this trend of a lot of people subscribing to your service, but not too many using it. Secondly, relatedly, you mentioned the costs being much lower than in Kenya and Tanzania. So is it primarily due to the intermediation and charges for the agents, or are there other reasons for it? I can understand competition, but that would lead to something. That's why I'm asking. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
What was the first? Penetration was the first one, right? So I think the last time we checked, it was in the low 80s. Mobile money as a percentage of the mobile phone subscriber base. Now, I don't have the figures for mobile phone penetration, but that is lower in Tanzania than it is in Kenya. So the overall numbers are smaller, but penetration of the mobile base is higher. active users. Yeah, active users are pretty high. I don't have the exact number, but actually what we found was pretty interesting was people are actually not enrolling and not using the service. So actually everyone's using it. And what's interesting is when you look at who's using what, they're actually, people tend to have two or three different accounts. I don't know which chart. Right. So this active accounts. That's active accounts on the right, yeah. And actually the number of inactive accounts was pretty small when we looked at the data. I do think that competition is the big driver, right? So what's interesting is when you go, so not only do the shops have the four logos and the four books and, you know, everyone can get any product, people also tend to have more than one mobile phone account and more than one SIM, and they actually switch depending on, you know, who's got a better offer for doing a specific type of call, a specific service. The operators also run deals on mobile money and have promotional rates on transfers, and so people actually swap SIMs in and out depending on who's got a good offer that day. It's also the only country where I've heard of a triple SIM phone, so you can actually switch between them. So, you know, if that's not competitive, I don't know what is. I know, like, I wanted to buy one, but I didn't have time.
This next question comes from Steve Lin, an independent agribiz consultant from Brattleboro, Vermont, and there are two sort of clarifying questions. The first one is, I'm curious about how Vodacom built up its rural rep network. It sounds like a huge job and investment. And secondly, how did tea growers end up with company ownership? Did they purchase shares?
Ask them how cold it is in Brattleboro.
I've forgotten the question now.
Sorry, the question again was about the rural rep network tea growers with company ownership.
And then ownership, okay. The rural rep network, so this was really the aggregators. So a lot of the money that Gates gave to Vodacom was actually to hire a company called AfriKings, who became the first aggregator. So they were essentially a kind of marketing agent and recruitment agent. They went out into rural areas, mapped all the resellers, educated them about the product, brought them on board, trained them. You know, it took a lot of effort to make this happen, and so that's why Vodacom couldn't do it themselves. They didn't have the field staff to do it, so they had to bring in these aggregators who could work in the field to do that. What was the other question? Ownership, right. So this gets a lot more airtime in the actual report. So the actual report, when we come out, deals with, obviously, this whole question of getting to scale. It also deals with the question of what do you do when you're at scale, right? And what's interesting for us is when you look at something like the MFI industry, the problems didn't go away when they were at scale. They just had different problems at scale than they had when they were getting to scale. And we're going to dig a little deeper into that. But in Kenya and KTDA, what's interesting is that in the 80s and 90s, you started having a whole bunch of problems coming up because it was no longer the, you know, the minnow of Kenyan agriculture, right, which was kind of under the political radar. It was now this massive, massive enterprise throwing off lots of foreign exchange, throwing off lots of money, controlled by government. So you can imagine the pressures and interference that were coming into that kind of organization through the 80s and 90s. And so what happened in the early 90s, and this coincided really with liberalization politically in Kenya and the return of multi-party democracy, and so the farmers decided, you know, actually we're kind of in revolt now, you know, because we're not seeing enough money come to us. We're seeing money sucked out of the system, corruption, you know, probably fraud, and we want control of the company. And so there was a whole kind of parliamentary group set up to deal with this. Over the course of 8 years, the farmers, politicians, and the government really got together and said, we need to map out a new course for privatization. Helped to a certain extent by pressure from the World Bank and IFC, who were trying to kind of, you know, obviously push privatization in lots of these countries. So So all these things really led to a blueprint that privatized the company and gave them to the smallholders. And actually the way that they did it was they sold the company to the smallholders, but instead of requiring them to pay cash, they would pay for it through tea. The company was sold to the factories, who were all set up as separate companies, and then the smallholders who supplied that factory all became shareholders in the factory companies. That's it in summary.
By the way, it's -8 in Brattleboro, Vermont.
Yeah, I'm Jennifer Bremer from DAI. Very interesting presentation, although I have to say a lot of the things like business success takes leadership and money and so forth is sort of probably not news. But nonetheless, the case studies are very interesting, but both of the ones that you presented are large companies. Mm-hmm. In the latter case, in a product area that is different from other kinds of contract farming, in that the product is not perishable and has a mass market, but still interesting. But my question is, this is perhaps a stupid question, but is the answer to how you get to scale start big?
Start big. That is a good question. We didn't choose these. We chose because they were quite interesting and they were technology based. In the final report, we will look at industries, you know, like MFIs that really kind of started small and then got to scale. But I do think, yeah, you start with certain advantages if you're already big, right? If you've got the government behind you, that helps with facilitation. That helps with money. Having the government stand guarantor for your loans, that kind of helped with getting more capital in to build factories. Having the government educate farmers reduces the risk of side selling, which is a huge risk with contract farming models. You know, so I do think, yes, there are certain benefits, you know, that brought, but, you know, I mean, KTDA would be the first example also of the risks that can bring, right? So you have a bunch of risks with government models that, you know, they won't be run professionally. Right, they won't be run commercially. There'll be political interference. So all those things also come with that. I think in the case of corporates, yes, they do have lots of money, but there's also a lot of internal competition for that money. Right, there's certain hurdle rates in terms of return that you need to get from investments that you make, which I think is why it's interesting to see in this case in Tanzania. You know, it's not that Vodacom didn't have money to build the agent structure. It's because they weren't incentivized to build the agent structure. You know, so it's recognizing, I guess, the kind of actor that you've got and figuring out how you can help them. So when you look at something like MFI in India, which all started with kind of small NGOs that are trying to get to scale, there was a lot more activity on capacity building, right? And getting them to kind of change structure, develop systems, develop skills to gradually scale the model, which is not the kind of thing you would do with a Vodacom in Tanzania. So I think there's all that, recognizing things are different. So let me stop there.
Yeah, just... And just to call it out, there's often a lot of reluctance in our field to kind of work with MNCs and to do things that flow money to MNCs, but to get big, it helps to be big, as you put it, and how many big things are there out there to work with? So something to keep in mind.
Yeah.
This question comes from Masvin Wildmarian, a PhD student at Addis Ababa University in Ethiopia. In most countries, it is the mobile network operators in collaboration with banks that deployed mobile money services. Will private non-mobile network operators be successful if they are interested in deploying these services as well?
Those are the models that we've seen be successful, and it makes sense that they would be well positioned, I guess, for success because they're riding on existing infrastructure, right? So one of the reasons that we talked about the challenges in Tanzania for Safaricom, the MNOs, but actually they also had advantages, right? So Tanzania actually has a pretty good mobile network in place that actually works. It's reliable. You know, the last thing you need if you're trying to move money in the network is it doesn't work or it fails when you're trying to make a transfer. That doesn't inspire confidence. So one of the reasons, for instance, we think it's not worked in some other countries like Uganda, for instance, it's a neighboring country, is this question of reliability and quality of the mobile network. So I think, it does depend on those other pieces. And if you happen to be a company that owns those, operates the other pieces, it helps.
Christina Planick, USAID. Kind of pulling back from the case studies and thinking about the larger lessons here for us, I think it's encouraging to know we love to believe that we can use our money in a catalytic way, especially with a private entity. So the example of Gates really kicking this off with Vodacom and you know, then they investing on top of that a lot more money. This is what we like to see and hope that we can replicate. But determining who to do that with, when to do it, and where to do it is really difficult for us. And I think a lot of times we're kind of casting about in the dark and hoping for a hit. So are there any other early indicators, besides what you said in terms of the fact that this needs to be a learning orientation, and if you're seeing changes in a business model, that's a good sign that they're on the right track. Is there anything else of that sort that we should be looking for when we're trying to figure out where to place our catalytic funds?
So I think there's two things to kind of look for and develop an understanding around, okay? I think one thing is there has to be kind of a latent chunk of value that could be seized and realized out there, right? So there has to be a bunch of people who are interested in mobile banking that don't have it yet, right? The work in low-income housing in India, there has to be a lot of people out there looking for low-income housing. There has to be some big chunk of money that could be realized that's not yet realized. And then around that chunk of money, there are barriers that are stopping someone from realizing that money. What are those barriers? And you have to map the system, right? And sometimes the system is so messed up that it's just, you know, it's not going to go anywhere. You're not going to be able to do anything about it. And other times it's so close to kind of breaking free that you've missed the boat and someone's already going to take care of it, probably the company with some first mover advantage. And you're kind of looking for that sweet spot. Well, where can we see the barriers, intervene well enough so that we can seize all this money? One kind of puzzle that keeps bugging me is fertilizer in Africa, right? We know if we apply more fertilizer to the ground, yields go up, and that's more money to be had, but something's sticking it up, right? What is that system that's sticking it up, and why can't we realize it? Could be one thing, but it's probably more than just one thing, right? And probably what has to happen is five things have to happen simultaneously, which gets to the who's the facilitator that can understand those five things and make them happen simultaneously.
Yeah. Just to build on that, I think this whole question of, you know, what's the market, and is there really a market opportunity, like many things, seems banal and seems basic, but it's so often overlooked, right? Especially if we come from an impact lens, because we think about beneficiaries and we think about their needs and, you know, what would be beneficial for their needs, and often what people need is not what they want, or certainly not what they want to buy. Right, and a lot of our work over the past 8 years has been really kind of understanding customers, right? And when you understand customers, it's not about understanding need; it's about understanding desire and understanding, you know, their ability to pay. And I think that's probably one of the biggest gaps that we see at the level of certainly the enterprises that are coming into this space. You know, that there isn't enough effort, you know, or maybe capability or sophistication around understanding customers and serving them. And I think similarly, I think when we're thinking about facilitation and working with them, you know, we have to bring that lens to the enterprise. Otherwise, you know, we'll be going down some dead ends.
So this question follows up on a very interesting conversation happening on the webinar about the tea leaves example, about the merits of cash crops versus food security. And Hans Mazura from AgriDev Solutions in Burlington, Massachusetts, was curious to know about the impact indicators that were used in the KTVA case for the social and economic impact.
So the main thing was really just the rise in payouts for growers, which I think we showed as one of the four charts. We did ask them if they'd ever, you know, done analysis of how household incomes have changed, and once again, they haven't done that. But the two indicators were really rising payouts, and then in recent years, they've also had dividends paid out to farmers. The reason we actually did try to push them on household incomes and who these incomes were changing for is that the industry, the structure of smallholders has changed over the years, right? So that's the other thing we don't talk about, which is actually the smallholders that we're describing in the 60s are not the smallholders we're describing in 2013. You know, in 2013, you're seeing a completely different structure. You know, some smallholders are small. They've got really small plots. They're giving them to their, you know, to their children. Some of those are not viable anymore because they're too small. On the other end, you've got, you know, large farms now where they're hiring people to, you know, pick the tea and cultivate the tea. So it is one of those questions, and I was saying, you know, it is one of those things we have to think about, you know, more going forward. How do we actually track impact and not just assume that it happens? We've just done, you know, the best that we can from the data that we had.
We'll take one last question from the room.
Hi, Chris McCray. I wanted to go back to the sort of microsystem dynamics which you started with in both of your presentations. For example, Kurt talked about micro-franchises with free criteria, having positive cash flow, serving the poor, and scale, and potential to scale. So when you look at that, or when you look at your ecosystem picture, have you come up with some clues as to who would you trust to sort of own the aggregation across many of those parts? I mean, is it a bank? Is it an educator? Is it the open technologist who actually wants to change the whole of the value chain in that sector? Who are the owners you'd most trust for connecting a lot of those small parts?
By owning, do you mean?
Well, ultimately the investors, but the investors who make sure that all of those things scale the way that they could have done, given you were saying in the case of the micro-franchises, I think you started with, 459 micro-franchises you've identified across Africa. So if you were to look for one owner, which was to investor, to do the most good across all of those, what sort of entity would it be?
Doesn't exist.
Yeah.
I don't know that there's one kind of player who would be able to do it. And I think part of what we're trying to do with this work is describe the range of different situations. You know, I think before we got into this, we never thought that we'd see a parastatal being a successful enterprise and facilitator. You know, it's not what you think, right? You think parastatal, you know, inefficient, they're never going to do it. Government, you know, too focused on the big picture, can't focus on innovation. But actually, they made it work. You know, so I think it's kind of horses for courses, really. You know.
I mean, you know, it's certainly different stages. You know, the kind of friends and family when they're small. I mean, things like that aren't going to change, but I do think you get to a certain point where somebody has to kind of come in and not and kind of be altruistic. You know, they can't be looking to make money off the system, because that just kind of turns people off and makes them suspicious. So, you know, a Gates can come in and like, well, that guy's not too worried about making money off me. I mean, he's pretty set. Has some credibility, you know, and so it's sort of, you know, gravitas, credibility, you know, not trying to, you know, take a piece of the action. And that's in kind of back to the leadership point as well. It's trite, but it's just over and over and over. When you look at these things, yeah, like there's names of people you can say and point to, and it's just kind of different in different places, and you just got to have to find those people. Yeah. And again, back to the problem is that, you know, there is some system of activities that has to happen for this to start netting out and going, and it's a dysfunctional system, and what are the barriers and points of dysfunction, and, you know, who can do what? And sometimes that's just the way it is. It's not going to change now. We're going to have to park that one. Sometimes the dam's about to break, you don't have to do anything, but there's kind of this big chunk of things in the middle where sometimes you can intervene and do something.
And just to pick up on the leadership point, you know, so we recognize whenever you put something like "it takes leadership" on a slide, people are going to say, well, you know, of course. And we did have our own arguments about whether to put it up, but it's true, right? So one of the things, it's true. I also think that there are some blind spots around leadership, you know, which I alluded to earlier. I think if you're an investor and you're putting money into a business, you naturally think about leadership, the team that you're backing, and do we want to back them, and do we believe in them to deliver this plan? I think those of us, you know, once you kind of elevate it to, I have this program, you know, I have a stage gate for this program, do I commit to 5 more years of this program? It's about developing a sector, you know, making linkages. often the leadership stuff then kind of recedes into the background. You know, we think about market size, we think about, you know, barriers, in all the stuff that we've described, you know, but actually, you know, once you start on that, who's going to be doing it? It's still the firms, it's still their leaders, right? If they don't have the leadership potential to make this happen, it still won't work. You know, so there's a kind of depersonalization that happens as we kind of step up to the level of industries and sectors that I think, you know, we're trying to speak against and say, actually, you know, we should also think about this element of individual leadership, even as we think about these very large scale programs and problems.
The other thing I would say is leadership is actionable. So you can say, well, if there's no leadership, there's nothing I can do about it. And that's kind of true, but you can also not invest behind it, right? So if you don't see the leadership there, you may want is, you know, really badly to fix this problem.
Right.
If it's not there, it's not going to get fixed. So just, you know, go someplace else.
Sometimes we put too much weight in our own leadership in a way, right? Because we're like, well, if we're leading it, we can make this change. But actually, generally, you know, any one of us, you know, especially if we're sitting somewhere other than where the change is happening, can't do that.
Yeah, please join me in thanking Harvey and Kurt. Thank you so much. Thank you for a great